This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Etopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak with ethicist Mildred Cho, PhD, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Welcome to Etopia Media Medical News Network.
Thanks.
Before we talk about the paper that you wrote with David Magnus, why don't you just give us a little bit of background on the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics, where it's situated within the university, what its mission is.
Well, our center is at the School of Medicine at Stanford, but we have a lot of members who are from other schools throughout Stanford, such as the Law School and the School of Humanities and Sciences.
So it's pretty much a cross-disciplinary center.
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
And so we do a lot of research on ethical issues related to especially advanced technologies such as stem cell research and genetics and so forth.
Tell us a little bit in general about how you, quote, do research. Do you talk to people? Do you sit around and think? Do you go into the lab? What's the process of biomedical ethical research?
Well, that's a good question, especially since it's so interdisciplinary. It tends to be all of the above.
Right.
So it can be sort of philosophers just sitting and thinking about sort of the meaning of new technologies, for example,
right,
on the meaning of, you know, what it means to be human, which
right,
is something that philosophers always have done.
Right.
Other people at our center, for example, are medical anthropologists, so they might be interviewing or observing people in the practice of medicine or in the research lab to find out more about, you know, sort of the factors that drive research or clinical practice.
Is there an agreed-upon canon of biomedical ethics? Is there an agency that is like the French Academy for the Academie Française for the French language? Is there a similar body for biomedical ethics, or are there conservative biomedical ethics and liberal biomedical ethics and pro-life and pro-choice biomedical ethics, or is there a single standard?
Well, that's a good question. There actually is not a single standard. But as with any kind of academic endeavor, it's pretty, you know, typical for an academic kind of activity, and it's still pretty much an academic kind of a thing. And it's also a very new field,
right,
in the United States, and it arguably began in the United States,
right,
in the maybe late 60s, early 70s, as a new discipline. So it is evolving in terms of, for example, providing training in the form of formal degree programs,
right,
which is tending to move towards some kind of common ground in terms of a canon. But I don't think there ever will be a canon, partly because also biomedical ethics covers a big territory. So, for example, at our center, we do everything from ethical issues in, you know, genetic research to clinical ethics consultation at the bedside.
Right.
And that covers a lot of different kinds of materials and calls for different kinds of background training that would be required.
Okay. Now, there's also a Stanford Stem Cell Institute that Dr. Irvin Weissman heads up. Is there a formal relationship between the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics and the Stanford Stem Cell Institute, or do you have any relationship with them, or do you have to vet things that they do, or do they do what they want, and if they feel like it, they ask you about it?
There's no formal relationship between our Ethics Center and the Stem Cell Institute, and there actually isn't any formal relationship between our Ethics Center and any other part of you know, the medical school or
right,
our campus, other than our kind of institutional affiliation with Stanford. And so the Stem Cell Institute is actually going to be guided by and is currently sort of their activities are determined by a number of school and university-wide committees that will have to make sure that the Institute complies with state and federal regulations, for example.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm trying to get at here, and it's going to sort of permeate what the discussion, where the discussion goes, is whether there's a kind of bright line about all of these things, or whether it's of the essence now that there are no bright lines, and that the institutional relationships between the different organizations and the different rules and the regulations and the funding and so on is really so nebulous as to allow for a lot of leeway and variations within the stem cell research project.
Well, with stem cell research in particular, because it's so new and fast-moving,
right,
the current regulations really don't necessarily cover all the different issues that come up,
okay,
or that will come up in the future from other kinds of research that,
right,
that may raise new ethical and social issues. So it is definitely a moving target,
because
and
it, yeah,
we have to kind of run to keep up with it.
Okay, what I want to find out is who's shooting at the target exactly, because as we're going to talk about specifically here about what the Koreans have done in terms of what the U.S. federal government and the California political system have been doing, is that essentially the scientists are moving faster than the politicians. And I'm wondering whether the bioethicists are moving as fast as the scientists or as slow as the politicians.
Well, we're definitely trying to keep up with the scientists here. And one of the things that we're doing at our Center for Biomedical Ethics is to try to integrate people who are thinking about the ethical issues more closely with the scientists to try to create mechanisms for knowing about what kinds of research scientists are thinking about doing, so that before they've done it, we've had some discussion about the potential ethical and social ramifications. And we've set up a program specifically to do that, which we call our Benchside Ethics Consultation Program, to address that very issue. And at a place like Stanford, which is moving at lightning speed on a number of fronts, this will become very important.
Okay, let's focus a little bit now on the subject of your paper Dr. Magnus, the egg donation issue. How important is the egg donation part of the entire embryonic stem cell research field?
Well, the stem cell research field is really broad. So, egg donation is just one part of that for generating new stem cell lines. So clearly there are other kinds of stem cells that don't require egg donation.
Right.
We're really just talking about the generation of brand new stem cell lines at the embryonic stage that's affected by egg donation.
Right. So research with adult stem cell, dedifferentiation of adult stem cells, cord blood stem cell research, none of that has anything to do with egg donations.
Exactly. So it's just this one sort of subset of stem cell research. Egg donation is, of course, critical to that, and that kind of research generates stem cells that have the most potential for clinical use.
Right. What's called somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Well, actually, you don't have to use the nuclear transfer procedure to generate stem cell lines.
Oh, explain that.
Well, so nuclear transfer actually doesn't even involve the creation of real embryos, in the sense that if you're going to create an embryo and some of the stem cell lines that have been used to date have been left over from in vitro fertilization procedures, where an egg from a woman is fertilized by a sperm, and that generates a blastocyst. And when the cells are dividing at that very early stage of development, the cells are used to make human embryonic stem cells. So okay, That's one way of creating those kinds of cells.
Right, and in fact, it's a little bit tricky, the language, but in fact, egg donation, or at least egg extraction, is certainly a central part of IVF, or in vitro fertilization, as well. And I'm going to want to compare egg extraction for the purposes of reproduction versus egg donation for the purposes of biomedical research.
Right.
But in fact, you can't make either IVF embryos for reproduction or somatic cell nuclear transfer blastocysts for stem cell derivation without having a human female donate an egg.
Right. So for the nuclear transfer procedure,
right,
you don't actually require it's not necessarily the same procedure, because that adds another step of taking a nucleus of a of an egg,
right,
and replacing it with another,
right,
nucleus.
Right.
So you don't even necessarily have to go through the whole fertilization procedure.
Right. You don't go through the fertilization procedure, but you need to have the egg to do it.
Right.
Okay. Do you have any idea, have you found in your research, or can you make an estimate about how many eggs are likely to be needed to carry out the plans for research that are contemplated?
Well, now with this new research that's been done in South Korea,
right.
They've really dramatically lowered the number of egg donors that will be necessary to create stem cells from the egg.
Could you estimate by what factor they've reduced that?
Essentially, they've got it down to almost a 1-to-1 ratio.
Is that right? Because the first a year ago, Dr. Huang's lab got one cloned embryo from 242 eggs, and apparently they've gotten 11 out of about it was close to a. Do you know exactly what the statistics were about how many they needed to get these 11 lines?
It was approximately.
I can look it up here.
Yeah, it was about a factor of 10. They've improved the procedure by about a factor of 10. And so they did start with 18 donors.
Right.
And they derived 11 stem cell lines from those 18 donors.
But they had multiple egg donations
from
each of them.
Right, donations.
Are you thinking that this indicates that with further refinement of the process, it ought to be one cloned embryo per egg?
No, what I was referring to before was sort of one cloned, one stem cell line per donor. That's what I meant by 1-to-1. And it may be that that could be improved. But you have to remember also that in the natural process of fertilization and implantation on the way to a normal pregnancy,
right.
That ratio isn't 1-to-1 either. So
What are the operative ratios in that?
I don't know what the exact numbers are, but it has been estimated that there's about I think about a 25% fertilization and blastocyst generation rate. So, you know,
I've got it right here in an article that I wrote that quotes an article in Times Online from Great Britain. The Korean group have produced 11 colonies of embryonic stem cells from 31 cloned blastocysts and 185 eggs. Their success rate was 16 times better than last year, mm-hmm. when 242 eggs were needed to make a solitary stem cell line. So it's down. It takes at least six eggs to get a. They're getting about a 16% success rate from eggs to 16% of the eggs are turned into blastocysts, and a third of the blastocysts are turned into stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially about 20 eggs, 20 eggs to produce one colony right now.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And presumably is about 20 eggs the number that a single female can donate at a time? Or close?
I think it's highly variable. It's probably, I think they got approximately 10 eggs on average per donor.
Okay. But are you expecting then that ratio would continue to get better?
The ratio
lowering the number of eggs that are needed to get a successful embryonic stem cell line, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it might be able to be improved, and you know, I'm not an expert in that actual research,
right?
But those researchers were asked that question, and they did say that they may be able to improve that a little bit, but there may be some kind of, a sort of natural ceiling on the efficiency of that process.
Right, okay.
And they may be getting close to that.
Does the efficiency of the process affect the ethics of the process, or does that remain the same, however effective the process becomes?
Well, I think there are a number of ways in which those issues are related. So,
okay.
First, if you can make the process more efficient and use fewer egg donors, for example, that would put fewer people into the possibility of you know, personal risk.
So it's an ethical thing to have a more efficient process so that fewer donors are required. Is that right?
Right, right.
Okay. And that implies then essentially that there's something risky, or I don't want to use the word negative, but there's some kind of onus on having more egg donations by more donors is not as ethically good as fewer egg donations by fewer egg donors. Would that be a safe conclusion from a logical conclusion from what we've just said?
Generally speaking, but it also depends on the benefits against which those risks are weighed.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about... Okay.
Right.
Just say a little bit about what the actual process is involved in the egg donation.
Well, in the kind of egg donation that's typically used and that was used for this research done in Korea,
right.
A woman comes in and is given a number of hormones to induce egg production, and then there's a small procedure that's done to extract the eggs. It's not a very involved surgical procedure. It's not like a full it's not like even as invasive as getting your appendix out or anything.
But before we talk about this, are we talking about specifically what was your involvement or your involvement with Dr. Magnus in the Korean study? Were you there from the beginning, and what kind of participation did you have? What was your relationship with them? Were you an integral part of the research, or did you get access to some of their data and procedures later? Or what exactly was the relationship between your work and the Hwang group in Korea?
That is a good question. We did not know about their research when they were first planning it, and only became aware of it in the process of the manuscript that they sent for publication being reviewed.
Oh,
so we were asked to review the ethical component.
You were asked by Science Magazine.
Right.
What do you think about the ethics, by the way? I read an article in Korea Times 3 days before the announcement in which the Korean Times reporter interviewed Dr. Hwang from the U.S., and he said, "We're not publishing any articles about stem cells in Science anytime soon," 3 days before they did it. Is that an ethical thing to do?
Oh, I hadn't heard
yes,
that. Maybe
he
misunderstood, or maybe he meant in the...
It was a Korean reporter talking to a Korean guy, so I figured there wasn't a language barrier.
No,
it was the Korean Times.
But, I don't know.
That's just sort of a side issue, but... So you were asked by Science Magazine to review the ethical aspects of the study.
Yes.
And did you get a copy of the consent form?
We got a copy of the consent form, which was also posted online.
Okay. I assume it was written in Korean and never translated to English, or was it?
Yeah, the translations are also available online.
Okay.
So those were translated. And we also had access to some supporting materials that were developed for the people who were potentially participating in the research. So they had supplementary informational documents.
Do you know how the donors were recruited by the Hwang team?
No, we don't know anything about the recruitment procedure. All that we knew was that the people that were eventually participants in the research, or at least donors for the research,
right.
Were not related to the people who were donating skin cells.
Right.
And that becomes significant because the people who were donating skin cells were recruited because they had particular diseases that,
right.
that may be amenable to stem cell stem cell types of therapies in the future.
Do you know at all how many women were originally recruited and how many after having the risks explained to them, and we're going to go into how thoroughly that was done, decided to participate, whether everyone recruited agreed or whether a large percentage dropped out after it was explained to them?
No, we don't know. We don't know how many might have dropped out or why if they did.
Okay, what was your evaluation of the consent form that was used in the Hwang for the Hwang donors?
It was difficult to tell because we were working off of translations.
Right.
And so And we're also, part of the difficulty was not just the translations, but that was somewhat of a difficulty because we're talking about the meaning of, you know, a lot of words in which the meaning in a United States context would be very important.
So you've got both linguistic and cultural,
so the linguistic and cultural
translation issues.
Translation issues, absolutely. And fundamentally, in the process of reviewing it, we did have the overall issue of reviewing research that is done in another country that has been reviewed by its own institutional mechanism.
Was it? How was it reviewed? Are there institutional review boards in Korea, and did one of them examine this
form? In Korea they have something that's equivalent of what we call institutional review boards here in the United States that review medical research and consent forms.
And they reviewed the consent form for this and approved
it. They apparently did. We were sent, and I think these are posted online as well, the approvals from the Korean IRBs and the translations.
Would the consent form, as you understand it, have passed muster with the Stanford University Medical Center Institutional Review Board?
Probably not. They probably would have asked for much more detail in the consent forms, especially where risks are concerned.
How much mention, as you understand it again, mention was there made of the risks involved in the research?
Well, my understanding, at least based on the documents that we saw, and we have no way of knowing what actually was communicated in verbal form.
Right.
But from the documents we saw, the kinds of risks that they seem to have mentioned there did not include what would typically be found, I think, in a clinical consent or a research consent of that sort in the United States, especially the risks of death or infertility.
What are the risks of being an egg donor in Korea or the United States or anywhere?
Well, some of the risks are more of inconveniences than real, you know, sort of permanent harm.
Right.
Such as some pain, bloating, nausea, that sort of thing, which are generally temporary. Some of the other risks, though, can include infertility and kidney failure and other things that are much more serious than that, albeit it's estimated at a much lower frequency.
What are the estimates or the record of the frequency of serious medical complications from being an egg donor?
Well, for the risk of infertility, it's been estimated at about about a half to 1%.
Right.
So, you know, some people might think that's a small percent.
Right.
For people who are undergoing the procedure because they are infertile, of course, that's
right.
You know, probably not an issue. But for someone who isn't infertile and goes in for that kind of procedure, that might sound like a big number.
It would, of course, ironically mean that for those people who become infertile, that they'd have to depend on egg donors if they wanted to have children.
Exactly. But, you know, again, there may be a cultural context here that we didn't, that was beyond our, you know, scope to investigate.
Well, do ethicists believe that there's a universal system of bioethics or that they're culturally determined and that egg donors in Korea ought to be warned at a level different than egg donors in the United States?
Well, that's kind of an ongoing discussion that has been going on in a number of different contexts, but I think there are some basic principles that we might be able to agree on that universal.
It's like human rights and individual political rights, I assume.
Well, yeah, in a similar vein. So, for example, we might agree on the general principle of autonomy or respect.
Right.
That we would respect people's rights or their wishes.
Right.
And where the different cultural contexts come in is, for example, some places having a greater sense of community autonomy over individual autonomy.
Right.
Or family. Or families being involved in decisions.
Or male domination. There's places where women who have premarital sex are entitled to, are subject to honor killings and murder to uphold the honor of the clan, the family, or the culture.
Right. So, you know, sort of in taking these different cultural contexts into account,
right.
you also have to take into account sort of whether there are some basic principles that are being violated
right.
there. But then also kind of try to maintain some respect for the boundaries of those principles.
So it's another lack of bright lines here, then, isn't it?
I mean, on the other, people in other countries, because bioethics has, as I said before, arguably started in the United States.
People right.
in other countries sometimes resent the imposition of American values onto their country.
This, of course, is a larger issue than we're prepared to talk about here. But this, the imposition of American values on other cultures is an ongoing and general subject of discussion around the world these days.
Right. So this trying to evaluate this study in Korea was sort of another example of trying to trying to find the appropriate boundary for evaluating it.
And what did you find overall? What was your overall ethical evaluation of what was done there in Korea in this experiment?
Well, I think that the researchers tried very hard and I think successfully to address the concerns that they would have had in their country. And as I said before, the IRBs in our country may not have evaluated them and come to the same conclusion. But we also have a lot of variability within our own country, both among IRBs. If you give, 10 different institutional review boards the same protocol, even within the United States,
right.
they all come up with different answers.
Okay. Now, in the paper that you wrote with Dr. Magnus, you distinguish among tissue donors, research subjects, and a new category that you suggest creating called research donors. What's the story there? Why aren't existing categories of player in the medical drama here? Why didn't you consider that sufficient? And why did you come up with this idea of a research donor? And what are the rights and responsibilities entailed with that?
Well, there is this. It seemed to us that there was a category of person who was involved in research, but not directly so, and their only involvement was to donate tissue, and then the rest of the research pretty much didn't have anything to do with, for example, a disease they might have or that sort of thing.
What's an example of these tissue donor type people?
Well, these tissue donors, we have tissue donors in research all the time. So anybody who donates blood
right.
Or sperm or... for example, if you've ever been in the hospital and have a biopsy, that biopsy material may have been used in research.
Right.
What's different about this new class of donors are two things. First of all, their donation was not made in the context of a clinical encounter. So some of these tissues, the blood, for example, or biopsy material, is taken for a clinical purpose.
Right.
And so people undergo the risks of extracting that tissue for direct benefit to themselves.
Right.
So that's one class.
Before we go on to research, you're right. What are research subjects as a class in this system?
So research subjects are people that participate in research and generally are participating because they have some medical condition or some reason to be in the research that for which they may benefit themselves, either not directly, but maybe down the line. So they have an interest maybe in participating in the research because they have a medical problem that they would like to see solved.
In a case, say for example, there's a new vaccine that needs to be tested either for its safety or its efficacy, presumably that would involve some patients who are in the diseased condition and some who are healthy. Typically, doesn't it? Are those research subjects we're talking about?
In the case of vaccines or preventative care, generally,
right.
often those are the kinds of things that are applied to people who are healthy with the hopes of keeping them that way.
Right.
But those people would who are participating in that research still have an interest in that research because it may be applied to them directly. So if it's a vaccine, you might not have, you know, measles or something, but you might be interested in a vaccine
that will keep
you from getting measles.
Right. So in other words, they're included as a party that could benefit from it in their role as a part of general humanity who could benefit by, or a general population that would benefit by the development of a good vaccine against
right.
a certain disease.
Right.
They don't necessarily have to have had it or even be at high risk for it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So we've got tissue donors and we've got research subjects. Why aren't those two categories enough for egg donors?
Well, it turns out in our research oversight system, if you donate tissue for whatever purpose, it is actually possible, and let's say you're donating that not for clinical purposes,
right?
But for research only.
Right.
If that tissue becomes anonymized later, so that your identity is no longer linked with that tissue,
right?
It's possible to then have research done on that tissue and not be considered research anymore.
How's that?
Because of the anonymity.
Okay.
Of the tissue. And so that is done under the assumption that the main risks of the research come through somebody losing privacy or confidentiality.
It's not essentially damage could be either physiological or to privacy rights, is
right.
what you're saying.
And so the idea about tissue donors is once you remove the potential dangers to the privacy, then you've pretty much solved the problem and you don't have to sort of provide those people with additional research protections. But the difference with the egg donors is that unlike blood donors or sperm donors, they do undergo or face a lot more potential individual medical risk.
In fact, isn't this kind of unique in that way, that people who give blood are other than a risk of an embolism or infection from the needle are really not at any great risk, whereas egg donors who undergo all the hormonal interventions to generate the hyperovulation are.
That's right. And so I think that's an important distinction that perhaps requires another level of research oversight. And actually, the National Research Council came out with a report about 2 weeks ago that that says just that.
And it's this category of research donors that you and Dr. Magnus are asserting ought to be created as a new category and have certain rights associated with it.
Right. And so some of the new guidelines that came out by the National Research Council specifically recommend that egg and sperm donors and anybody who donates tissue for the purposes of embryonic stem cell research should get the full protections afforded to any research subject, even though they may not be the subjects of research directly and even though they may not be undergoing those procedures for their own clinical benefit.
Okay, and what are those rights or privileges that pertain to research subjects that you feel research donors ought to have?
Well, they should be able to have all of the procedures they undergo reviewed by the Institutional Review Board as well as the consent processes so
okay.
that it's very clear to them that they are participating under risky conditions and also that they will not benefit themselves from the procedure. And also one of the points that David Magnus and I tried to make was that it's given that these people do undergo a procedure that is risky with no benefit to themselves, it's really important that they understand that there may not be direct benefit to anyone else either for some time because it's still a very new type of research.
And these admonitions need to be incorporated into an informed consent form and they need to sign it. after reviewing it.
Right, and you know, even more, even beyond that, there's, you know, too much attention paid to the sort of legalistic side of the process, the wording in the document,
right,
the signing and all that, but it's very hard for people to receive that message when it's not really delivered by the research community. And even if it's written on the forms, if it's not discussed in that same way,
right,
then you know, I think that the discussions can really blur the information that's trying to come across in the forms. And part of that is because of the language that we use. So we talk about gene therapy and stem cell therapy,
right,
and therapeutic research, as if research was therapeutic, and most research isn't therapeutic. And so we use a lot of terminology that is misleading.
Well, and speaking of terminology, I'm hoping to interview Leon Kass, the head of the President's Council on Bioethics, later this week. His panel produced in 2002 a document called Human Cloning and Human Dignity, an Ethical Inquiry, and it distinguished between cloning to produce children and cloning for biomedical research. Presumably, in the egg donation issue, there ought to be a clarification along the lines of egg donation to produce children and egg donation for biomedical research that would similarly alert donors to the purpose of what they're doing, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, and I think the term that was developed to distinguish reproductive cloning from non-reproductive cloning,
right,
was called therapeutic cloning.
Right.
And I think that was an unfortunate choice.
Well, the intention of the President's panel on bioethics is to replace the term reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning with the implied assumption that the therapeutic cloning is therapeutic, is to call it cloning to produce children or cloning for biomedical research, which I think the egg donation community could adopt as egg donation to produce children or egg donation for biomedical research.
Yes, I agree. I think cloning is also an unfortunate term.
Yes, well,
maybe we can think of something better than
right,
that.
Right. Asexual reproduction.
Well, it's not even reproduction at a certain level.
Right.
It's not reproduction until a lot more steps have happened.
Right. So creation of diploid cells.
Something. We need a better word.
Okay. We'll work on that. Is it your view as an ethicist that egg donors ought not to be compensated? Egg donors, for what we will call here donors for biomedical research, egg donors for biomedical research, ought intrinsically and essentially not be compensated for their donations?
I think they shouldn't be, other than sort of, you know, incidental costs like transportation or sort of costs incurred in
Their expenses.
Right, exactly. Beyond their expenses, I think.
Again, this is another nebulous area. Is that subject to abuse, do you think, or is that pretty straightforward? Is it pretty clear what that means, that they shouldn't have to be out of pocket for anything, but they shouldn't go away with extra money? Is that essentially what we're talking about?
Yeah, and I think there's a very strong consensus about that.
And what's the importance of that in the whole scheme of things?
Well, It's just really important that we don't get into a situation where, you know, there are incentives for people trying to give eggs because they would be paid a lot for it in a research setting. So people, you know, would be given incentives to put themselves at risk for research that are beyond you know, just wanting to do it because you really believe in the research.
So the purpose there is to essentially to protect poor people from themselves, is it?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's also in the same spirit as not trying to create a market for organs. And there is a very strong black market for organs, but, you know, the research community feels very strongly that it just doesn't want to get into that business.
So in fact, one can donate a kidney, but one can't sell it. Is that about right?
Correct.
But there, as you've just said, a black market in bought and sold kidneys.
Yes, there is one, but you know, the legitimate research community, you know, doesn't want to get involved in that black market.
Doesn't want to
create another one.
Doesn't want to be tarred with that brush,
right,
essentially. But is there any way, obviously an illegal or at least unethical black market in bought and sold organs of adults hasn't been stopped by the ethical or legal strictures against them. Is there any reason to think that there wouldn't develop, that a black market in human eggs wouldn't develop in the face of ethical and or legal constraints against paying donors of eggs?
Oh, it would be very hard to get around all of the research protections that we have, and that's why we have all the consent and all that kind of stuff. And
so you're saying that even though, apart from watching Law and Order and seeing where this sometimes causes trouble, I'm not familiar with the market forces in and the extent of black market in human organs, but it does exist. Are you saying that the ethical and legal strictures in surrounding biomedical research in these areas is going to prevent almost by definition unethical researchers from obtaining eggs by paying for them to poor women who want to just opt out of this whole ethical system and just get money for doing it?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much scrutiny of the research activities, and especially of stem cell research,
right,
that it just wouldn't be something that somebody could get away with for
okay.
very long.
Okay. So focusing then on the donors, the requirements are that they be informed and that they have their expenses reimbursed, but not be paid. So you're saying that the only people who can ethically become research donors are people who want to benefit mankind.
That's right.
Okay. Now,
might be a small group.
Well, that's what I want to address exactly now. But before we do that, let me ask this question: on the pages that appear on Utopia Media Medical News Network, there are Google ads, and often those Google ads are from companies offering to pay $10,000 or more to women for their eggs for reproductive purposes, as we distinguish between cloning to produce children and cloning for biomedical research and egg donation to produce children and egg donation for biomedical research. What's the ethical distinction that allows egg donors who undergo the same risks and undergo it to produce children and get paid $10,000, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for their eggs versus women who would donate for biomedical research and receive car fare?
Well, there's a sort of couple of different differences, but the major one is that if somebody's participating in research, it's very different than someone participating in for example, any kind of organ donation.
Right.
Because at this stage in the game, you know that if someone is donating an organ, that there is a fair likelihood that someone else is going to directly benefit from that.
Right.
So just to look at that from the research donor's point of view, again, you don't want to provide huge incentives for people doing something from which, there may be no benefit to anyone, which is really different from, for example, donating a kidney. And another thing that's different, which is really different for all kinds of reproductive services, is for whatever reason in this country, and I don't really understand why, I have to admit, those kinds of reproductive services are really very unregulated, and in contrast, the research activities that involve the same kinds of procedures are enormously regulated.
So you're saying that the donation,
it's just sort of a fluke in our system.
Well, you're saying that the reason for this anomaly is because research is regulated, and in vitro fertilization clinics aren't.
Basically, right.
And that they're therefore free to pay $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 for an egg, whereas, so for example, across El Camino Real in Palo Alto, there's the Advanced Reproductive Clinic that Dr. Adamson runs. So you're saying, so if you're, let's say you're a hypothetical generic Stanford undergraduate woman who feels like she'd like to, who would like to get $10,000 since the tuition's $40,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And she could walk across El Camino Real and give Dr. Adamson an egg and get $10,000, or she could come over to the University Medical Center and give it to humanity for nothing. What's she going to do?
Right, exactly. Well, I think that is a big inconsistency in our sort of generalized way we deal with the egg donation.
Do you think this
And you also notice that people don't get paid that much for their sperm.
No, but that's that. But right.
I mean, obviously, that's because of the differences in the risk involved. But
right. So are you expecting, this is sort of outside of your role as an ethicist, but as an observer of this whole process, given the strictures that you've said need to be in place to regulate and to maintain the ethics of the research enterprise, do you think that enough eggs will be donated in order to fund isn't the right word, to support the level of research that's envisioned?
I think that if people were given the opportunity, that yes, there would be enough people who would be takers in that. And my concern actually would be that there might be too many people who come forward without understanding the risk. So I'd be more concerned about trying to kind of beat people back at the doorway to make sure that. People aren't sort of rushing in without really understanding.
Okay, before we talk about that, it is closely related to that. What do you believe the ethical position ought to be of the organizations that are getting the eggs donated to them vis-a-vis the post-donation health of the women? They're not going to do their dental care for them, but if any of these risks materialize and the women become ill, or infertile because of their donative work, is it the ethical responsibility of the recipients of the eggs to pay for that?
Well, typically when people participate in research, if there are
sequelae,
adverse effects of
right.
that participation, the institutions that are doing that research have sort of limited. Have limited their responsibilities.
So
people who participate kind of do it
at their own risk.
At their own risk.
Consent forms that have been approved by institutional review boards contain explicit limitations of liability on the part of the organization, saying that if you get sick after you do this, you're on your own.
Basically, yeah.
And people sign it anyway.
And so some small kinds of care or medications may be included, but usually you're sort of left to whatever you might have from your health insurance or other sources of health care.
Do you think that's ethical? That some people are that the organizations are benefiting and not assuming the liability or the risk or the responsibility for any damage that's caused by the action of the donor?
Well, I think that the researchers should have some responsibility there. I think, again, part of the reason that this process has evolved this way is because of this emphasis on a kind of legalistic approach
right.
through these consent forms.
Right.
So when you put things down in writing like that, institutions become very wary about getting involved, and promising all kinds of health care or getting involved with all that liability because it becomes like a legal document.
Well, and even with that, then, to get back to your beating them off with a stick concern, you think then that even with the organizations being able to explicitly limit their liability to exclude any future responsibility, any post-donation responsibility for the women, and not pay them. And of course, we've left out the ethics of whether the therapies that may be developed from their tissue will rebound to them. They get no if Genentech licenses something based on someone's tissue research based activity and makes $1 billion. The donor doesn't get a penny, right?
Right.
And that's another aspect of the consent. you still think that with the no medical coverage, no rights to participate in the profits from the research, risks of death and infertility, and not being paid anything, that the women will be rushing to do this?
Well, I think some people who might have a family member or a child, for example, with an illness that and for which they're hoping for a cure.
Right. Haven't you just said that an important part of this is that they need to be informed that there is the possibility that there no cures will come of this?
Absolutely. But I still think that there are lots of people there who are very, very attuned to the possibilities of stem cell research.
Right.
Precisely because they have loved ones that might have a spinal cord injury or something, and they're desperately hoping for something and that they would step up to the plate. And I just hope that the people who do so, I think, you know, it's a very worthy goal to aspire to, but I just am concerned and hope that they are able to go through a well-informed consent process.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up with this question about the efficacy of what you're doing and who takes what you do and runs with it and what you expect or what you're going to be working on yourself or with Dr. Magnus to implement the proposal that you've made here in your document that accompanied the Huang study in terms of having these systems put in place by whoever's in charge of putting them in place.
Well, at the federal level, there's already been a lot of thought and guidelines. Again, I'll mention the National Research Council guidelines from a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
But there's a lot of implementation that has to happen at the local level through IRBs. So, you know, we're hoping through, for example, the publication of articles like ours that IRBs will be able to get additional guidance from them. And we also hope to work more directly with researchers themselves to have more informal dialogues that allow us to know more about what kinds of research are planned and also for the researchers to have more opportunities to discuss their research in the context of potential ethical and social implications before they've actually done the research.
Speaking of before they've actually done the research, there hasn't been any of this egg donation in the United States at all yet, has there? Since there isn't any of this the California research, which was to be in the forefront of all this, is dependent on the sale of $3 billion in stem cell bonds, which is now being held up in the courts for an indefinite period, and efforts to find bridge financing are apparently not availing much. So this isn't going forward in California, although it is going forward in Korea, and we've talked at great length about what happened there. Is this still a prospective issue? Are women donating eggs for stem cell research anywhere in the United States now?
No, as you say, not right now. You know, it's something that will have to be supported through non-federal funds.
Right. So the strategy essentially that you're using is to publish and then hope that individual institutional review boards at various medical centers will adopt your system. The federal government isn't going to implement it. Or are you trying to get the Institute for Regenerative Medicine and the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee in California to adopt your proposal?
Yes. I mean, a lot of what we said does overlap with the federal recommendations by the NRC. But generally speaking, yes, I think that we would like to see many of the issues that we raised in our paper addressed by other bodies that are going to be setting policy in this area, especially the issue of different states and different countries having different policies.
Exactly. That was my last question. Are you worried that some, or are you going to the UN with this? Because if some countries adopt less stringent procedures, they naturally would have an advantage, wouldn't they, in moving ahead with this research more aggressively?
Yes, and it does create a lot of problems for researchers because it's, you know, increasingly an international kind of a endeavor. And
won't researchers then gravitate to those places? It would be a race to the bottom, and those jurisdictions. Because, for example, I did an article last week about the cooperation among Ian Wilmot, who cloned Dolly in Scotland, and Dr. Hwang in Korea, and Gerald Chatton in Pittsburgh, who helped out with the Hwang study a lot, apparently, and collaborates with him already. This research will be done in Scotland, where you can get a license to do cloning, in Korea, where this is going on, and not happen in California or the United States, where the focus right now is on the president saying he hates cloning and he doesn't want to see a world in which it's accepted, so that you'll be putting forward high standards, but since the Republican Party is apparently, well, the president anyway, is standing in the way of this research, your standards won't be implemented, and the research will gravitate to countries with lesser standards. Is that an issue?
Well, that's certainly a concern, and the problem that still exists is when researchers from different countries collaborate
right.
with those from other countries.
Right.
It's not necessarily clear the extent to which the regulations or guidelines in your home country apply when you're working with people abroad. So what does it mean to do stem cell research, in Korea when
right.
you live in the United States?
It looks like globalization plus the scientific community's principles of operation are lapping the politicians again.
Yes.
And in fact, now I read an article over the weekend where Dr. Wilmot is working with someone in the UK who has motor neuron disease, and Dr. Hwang has agreed with Dr. Wilmot that Dr. Wilmot will send a skin cell from this patient in the UK to Dr. Hwang, who will use it for cloning for biomedical research, and send the stem cell line back to the Roslin Institute in Scotland, where they'll work on further differentiating and working on the stem cell line. Who's in charge of determining whether the Korean eggs that are used to do this are obtained ethically under UK standards?
Well, exactly. It's again, it's another moving target, and I think most countries haven't really thought out the implementation of their own regulations to that level of detail.
Okay, well, it's good that you're thinking about it over there at Stanford, and I want to thank you for that and for talking to us about it today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Don't hang up, but let me thank you again on the air for your work. Bye.
Bye-bye.